some of you may remember, he visited here quite some time ago, in 86, was it?
Or 85, even.
Maybe 85. That visit was a year or two after he discovered the now famous Jones polynomial, and before he was awarded a Fields Medal for that work and other work that he's done. Vaughan got his degree at the University of Geneva, and is now at University of California, Berkeley, and was this past weekend giving a wonderful talk at PIMS, and he's going to talk today on screen theory and beyond, something that I don't know if I got that quite right.
Okay, thanks, Dale. Thanks for the invitation to give the colloquium. So, I guess the century before last, so the 19th century, people, for somewhat bizarre interests, got very interested in knots, and they didn't have too many mathematical techniques for talking about them, but they could enumerate them. And there's a wonderful knot table, which you'll find in Dale's book, local book, which was basically the result of this 19th century work. And it includes pictures of all of the knots up to 10 crossings. So there's about 200 of them, I suppose. So it starts off with this one, which is the unknot, of no great interest. And then there's the trefoil knot, which is the first real knot. And then there's the figure of eight knot. And then they go on, and you get more and more elaborate pictures. And along the way, this is one of the ones that you run into along the way. Sort of my favorite for some reason, and I like to draw it every time so I don't forget how to draw it. It's very easy to forget how to draw these knots. Anyway, as I said, you write them all down up to this one has six crossings, this one has four crossings, so on. Eventually you find it's about 165 with 10 crossings, and then that's the story. But then, of course, you know, there's no reason why you shouldn't have 11 crossings and 12 crossings and so on. Well, the story of today's lecture begins sometime in the 1950s when John Conway, it's John Horton Conway, the notable mathematician of all sorts, was in high school, and he got interested in knots, and in particular he wanted to extend these knot tables beyond the 200 odd knots up to 10 crossings. He wanted to go to 11 crossings. And by this time there were certain tools available for the classification of knots, and the most well known and universally useful of those is the so-called Alexander polynomial. I'm going to have quite a bit to say about that in this talk. So the notation is delta sub k of t. So this is the Alexander polynomial. The k refers to the particular knot that we're talking about, and t is the variable in the polynomial. Okay. I'm not going to tell you what it is as a mathematical object, but I'll tell you what it is for these knots up here. For this one, it's 1. It's a sort of normalization condition. For this one, it's t plus t inverse minus 1. For this one, so you see it's a Laurent polynomial, you get negative powers of t. For this one, it is 3 minus t inverse. And for this one, it is minus 3 plus 3t plus 3t inverse minus t squared minus t to the minus 2. Okay, and as the knots, basically in general, as a general rule, as the knots get more and more complicated, so the Alexander polynomials get more and more complicated. The use of it, of course, is that it's an invariant of the knot. If you draw different pictures of the same knot and go and calculate its Alexander polynomial, you get the same polynomial. So if you're interested in, you know, building a table and you want to check whether you've got the same knot twice, then the first thing to do is to calculate its polynomial, because the polynomials, it's pretty easy to you know, we all agree, even if you don't know what a polynomial is, you agree that this one is different from this one, right? Just is. Anyway, so Conway wanted to go beyond the 10 crossing knots. He wanted to do the 11 crossing knots, and I should say he did do the 11 crossing knots, pretty much. And his planned tool was going to be the Alexander polynomial. Good idea. So he wanted to be able to calculate it rapidly for any given knot. And he was obviously a very forward-thinking high school kid, because he also wanted to use computers to do this. He wanted to write a computer program to help him enumerate and classify these knots. So it was in the 1950s, a kid at high school. I think that's really quite something. What he needed was a method which would be easily programmable and quite rapid for computing this Alexander polynomial. Okay, so I'm going to tell you what his method is, and this will actually be enough information for you, if you want to go away afterwards and compute Alexander polynomial of any knot that you care to. Okay, this is a little challenge for you, a homework exercise. So here's the method. It's sort of quite simple, but it contains the essential ingredients of everything I want to say afterwards. So, the idea is, well, first of all, we have to extend our context a little bit. We have to talk about oriented knots and links. I said the word links. You also have to allow knots with more than one component if you want to carry out this procedure. Okay, so this is the idea. We have three knots, or links, which have the property that they're almost identical, rather they have pictures that are almost identical. So we have K plus, K minus, and K zero, which are absolutely the same everywhere except at this one crossing. Okay, and at this one crossing, their pictures differ according to this scheme here. So imagine a whole lot of chicken wire that you would put over this one here, over this one here, and over this one here. Then the whole chicken wire, together with these extension, you know, finishing it off with these little bits of chicken wire, would be these three knots, K plus, K minus, and K zero. And the relationship that Conway used, apparently it was known in some sense beforehand, was that whenever this is true, no matter what the chicken wire is outside this picture, the Alexander polynomials are necessarily related by the following formula. Okay. Delta K plus minus delta K minus is the square root of T minus 1 over the square root of T delta K 0. Now, no matter how many times I give this talk and I write down this formula and I tell people not to bug me about the square root of T, there always someone asks me, what about that square root of T? So I'll tell you about the square root of T right now. It turns out you can easily prove that when you apply this formula, and I'm going to tell you how to do that in a second, when you apply this formula, the square root of T will disappear and you'll get an honest polynomial in T if the number of components of the link is odd, and it will be the square root of T times a polynomial in T if the number of components is even. Okay, so that takes care of that. All right. So this is the relation, and this is what he called the Skein relation, or come to be known anyway as the Skein relation. All Right, well, how do you use it? So let me now convince you that this skein relation suffices to calculate the polynomial of any order length that you care to ponder. And like I said, you should be able to go away afterwards and go ahead and calculate and check any of those knots of links. So the idea is as follows. It sort of goes back to other Alexander a couple thousand years ago, who demonstrated quite graphically that if you allow yourself to cut the string, you can untie anything, right? So so that's the way you do it. What that means, if you can untie the knot by sort of opening the string and passing it through, then if you take a picture of a knot, somewhere in that picture there must be a crossing that simplifies the knot if you change it. Okay? Somewhere there must be something that simplifies it. Okay. So then we just go at it by induction. So we take the picture that we want to calculate. Let's get one. So here's, suppose that, well, let's get one that guarantee you can see visibly will simplify it. If I change that crossing, then if you stare at that diagram a little bit and you change that crossing, you'll see the whole thing unravels. Okay, so this particular crossing will simplify the knot if you change it. So we change it. So you stick in the orientations, and you'll see that this particular knot here becomes the thing with, becomes the K plus of a triple. Okay? Then K plus is the knot we're trying to calculate. K minus is the one which is simpler. So by induction, we've already got it. And K zero, of course, much simpler because it has one less crossing. So by induction, we've certainly calculated it. So that's the end of the proof. We can now simply build up Alexander polynomials of all knots and links just by induction. You just do them one after another. Every time you come to a new one, well, then you just reduce it to the list that you already have.
Why is K minus simpler than K plus?
By choice of the crossing. So the first part of my proof said there has to be a crossing for which it's simpler. Okay? Because you can always untie it if you allow yourself to pass through. Or you might say, well, how do you find it? Well, you know, work. But in fact, it turns out that just about always, if it's a new knot, you change the crossing, it'll simplify it. If it's, if there's no obvious ways to undo it, then anything, changing any crossing will simplify it. So, well, actually, one thing, comment that I made the other day, is that this is interesting because it's sort of, you see that algorithm is inherently exponential time, right, in the number of crossings, because every time you simplify, you take a knot and you simplify it, well, you simplify it, but you introduce two more, right, and then you go ahead. So a crude scheme to do this, you would be doubling the number of knots that you have to look at every time you apply this algorithm. So it looks very bad in terms of computational complexity, okay? But the fact is that what legend has it, in fact, Conway says himself, that he found that this algorithm was so damn good that he didn't need a computer at all. And in fact, he reckons that he did all of the knots up to 10 crossings. He worked out all of their Alexander polynomials in an afternoon. Okay? I'm still not convinced I believe that, but he's not here to defend himself. Sorry? Couldn't even draw them all. Anyway, so there we go. So I think it's an interesting example of how... there are, by the way, this Alexander polynomial, because of other topological interpretations of it, is actually a polynomial. Anyone could make a polynomial time algorithm to determine. It's actually a sort of fairly simple determinant. But that is a really time-consuming process. Okay, so it's an interesting and typical example where the inherently exponential time algorithm is in practice a lot faster than the polynomial time algorithm that you might care to use.
The user judiciously choosing.
Well, you see, what happens is it's more what happens after you've changed it. You simplify it, and actually, instead of just simplifying a little bit, it simplifies a lot, and the whole of the tree just disappears afterwards. Like as we saw in that example, if we change that particular crossing, it unraveled completely. So there's a judicious use, but sort of just for your average knot, you take the average crossing, then you change it, and you get something a lot simpler.
Does the Alexander polynomial distinguish all knots up to 11 crossings?
No. No. It doesn't.
Did you say what you do if you get a link instead of a knot?
Just to keep, do the same thing. The algorithm that I gave really inevitably uses involves links and knots. Because if this is a knot, this is also a knot, but this is a link with two components.
So you just keep working down.
Just keep working down, yeah. Okay. So that's a nice little piece of anecdote from history or prehistory. So I'd like to just rephrase that algorithm that I gave in a slightly different way, and a somewhat easier way, really, as simply saying that suppose you take the space of all knot diagrams, all pictures of knots, and you filter it by the number of crossings. You filter it by the number of crossings. And then you also linearize, so you take linear combinations, or formal linear combinations. Then what this relation means is, and then you quotient out by this relation, okay, then what this means is sort of modulo things with less crossings, this is the same as that. Okay, so therefore, you can untie everything. So that's another way of saying slightly more sophisticated mathematical terms, and that's the one that I want to stick with. The arguments in the skein theory are always, things are equal, modulo simple pictures with less crossing, less things happening in them. Okay. Now, then what happened, just to continue with the history of this, this got picked up on somewhat later in the 80s when it was realized by a bunch of people whose initials start with these letters that, in fact, there's nothing particularly special about these coefficients here. That, you know, you can put an A here and a B here and a C here. The algorithm still works just as well as it did before. There's nothing, never used that particular form. So in fact, you get a polynomial invariant with apparently three variables, but in fact it's homogeneous, there's only two. So there's this Homfli polynomial, as it's called, of two variables. So that's very nice. Now, of course, it's not so clear that there is a... In fact, it's known to be inherently... well, it's equivalent to other problems that would be NP complete. Okay. So equivalent to problems that are known to be NP complete. So you can't do this in polynomial time. If you could, you could do lots of other things in polynomial time, but you're not supposed to be able to. Okay. So that's the story with Homfli. By the way, I say that I often get people telling me that this polynomial, you know, is really hard to compute, and that if you want to do about 12 or 13 crossings, you're stuck. This seems to be an illusion that people carry around. It's not true at all. I have a program that will perfectly happily calculate the polynomial of a 50-crossing knot, this Homfli polynomial. So, you know, once again, in practice, although in theory it's exponential, in practice it's not that bad. So then after that, Lou Kaufman came along and made two rather wonderful contributions to the theory. He observed that there's a specialization of this Homfli polynomial, which can actually be calculated by the simplest sort of skein theory imaginable. It was very direct. He showed that if you choose A and A inverse, or if you choose A judiciously, then you can... Sorry? Oh, yeah. Thanks, Dale. Then you can just take a knot diagram and directly reduce the crossings. You just replace the picture with this crossing by the picture with that crossing completely removed and this one completely removed. Okay, it's still inherently exponential to look at it, but it's incredibly simple, and you can turn this into a purely and absolutely explicit formula that you write down for this particular polynomial, a specialization of that one. And so this is excellent skein theory. This is just... You know, as good as you can get. You just immediately reduce the crossings to, and just let them get rid of them all. And then he also gave another polynomial which has two variables, known as the Kaufman polynomial, which has the property that, let's see. I just have to carefully vary them. So it is that this plus this equals x times this plus this. Anyway, I won't go into details. There's a way to fiddle in another variable into this polynomial, but it has this Skein theory, okay? This is the underlying Skein relation. Now, once again, that same argument that we gave, started off with the Alexander or Conway polynomial, will work just as well for this one, because it says that modulo things with less crossings under is the same as over, and therefore you can reduce it and calculate. Of course, all of this is begging a very important question, which is, how do you know this invariant exists? Okay, the algorithms I've given are clearly sufficient to actually calculate the invariant, but how do you know that it exists? Okay, well, for the Alexander polynomial, it was because it's some other part of topology, and it's just a formula. For Homfli, these people were actually faced with the problem of trying to prove from the Skein relation that there was such an invariant. Okay, that's a bit more tricky. And similarly, Kaufman was forced to prove from the Skein relation that there actually was an invariant of not satisfying this relation. And that's still a very difficult thing, I think, in this theory that I'm going to outline today, is to actually try to prove directly from these Skein relations that what you hope exists actually does exist. I mean, for instance, you could say in this Kaufman thing, why can't you have different coefficients in this one? Well, you can't, and in fact, it's fairly obvious that you can't if you think about it. But, you know, what's the theory? What's the theory? And that theory, the existence theory, is really in an extremely primitive state. Okay, so one thing... If you do these arguments, even if you try to do these existence proofs, you immediately run into... knots with lots of points on the boundary, so-called tangles. It's really, even in this very first relation, what's going on here is that you have a knot with a boundary, a knot with four boundary points inside this picture, a particularly simple one. But remember, outside this picture, there's also a big knot with four boundary points. And, you know, just extending that language, which you're forced to do, you're forced to sort of consider so-called tangles, which are knots with, you know, an arbitrary even number of boundary points, so you'll have some kind of stuff in, like so, okay? And this is what Conway called a tangle. So it's a generalization of knot. You take a disk and you take 2n boundary points on that disk, and then inside that you have a sort of knot-like picture, which you consider up to the obvious three-dimensional knotty isotopies. You can sort of push things around in sort of three-dimensional way. So that's a tangle, and it's fairly clear, it's sort of part of the language you would be led to it, that these tangles can be combined. You can actually have a sort of calculus of these tangles, where you can combine them. You can get rid of any crossings in the knot diagram and put all of your crossings into these tangles, and you'll have a sort of operation on tangles where you can join them up in a sort of fairly arbitrary configuration like that. So there's a lot of operations. What I'm trying to say is there's a lot of operations on tangles. So I can put any tangle in here, any tangle in here, any tangle in here, anyone in here, and I'll get out a tangle. All right, so one gets a structure which turns out to be some kind of operad-like structure, which is these diagrams, like this, with a very carefully counted even number of boundary points around each of these disks. Okay, and you can imagine doing an abstract theory of operations of these diagrams and so on. So that's just, you know, language structure that you're led to immediately from these tangle pictures. Now, to continue the history of these Skein theoretic invariants, what happened was, at this point, a big machine took over the theory of Lie algebras and quantum groups and simple and semi-simple Lie algebras. Sort of took over and sort of left this elementary Skein theory in the dust. It established that, in fact, there's lots and lots of polynomials. In fact, what you can do is you can take a simple Lie algebra and you can get an invariant, a polynomial invariant of knots and links, where you assign an irreducible representation of that Lie algebra to each component of the link. Okay, and these ones are just simple special cases. Okay, so it seems maybe that Skein theory wasn't so exciting after all, because if you took, say, you know, if you took a 15-dimensional representation of SU3, it would, by the definition of Skein theory, of general Skein theory that I'm going to give, it would have a Skein theory, but it would be so complicated that maybe you would never want to use it. On the other hand, there's a device called cabling in knot theory. We just sort of take a knot and then replace one string by two or three or something like that. And pretty much every one of these fancy Lie algebra invariants that anyone has ever cared to get can be obtained from these very basic ones. This one, the Kaufman one, corresponds to the orthogonal and symplectic groups. This one corresponds to the special linear group or algebra. And as we know, we can sort of pretty much, up to some nasty little details, we can get all the representations of these Lie algebras by tensoring the basic one. And this is the one from the basic representation. So in fact, in terms of anything that's any good or, you know, readily calculable, they really are accessible. Underlying them is the simple Skein theory and the geometric operation of cabling. So the Skein theory plays a slightly ambiguous role in this whole general theory. It's very useful for calculating the very basic ingredients, not so useful for calculating the more complicated ones, but it's still there underlying the whole theory. All right. So now I would like to change topics a bit and put on a somewhat different hat. This was all basically something to do with topology. Now I'd like to talk briefly about a subject which is somewhere between algebra and analysis, and that's Feynman algebras. But in the interest of time, I'm going to basically skip essentially everything, at least all of the analysis. And we're just going to imagine that we have a pair of algebras, one contained in the other. So this is some algebra over the complex numbers with an identity. And I'm going to assume that the identity of M is the same as the identity of N, and that they're all sitting there. Right, now the point is, the kind of algebras that interest me are actually infinite dimensional algebras of operators, linear operators on a Hilbert space. Okay, but in order to avoid all of that history, I'm just going to assume that they're algebras and tell you that they have certain nice properties. Okay, certain nice properties. And the nice properties are what allow you to do the following thing. All right, so what is the following thing? We're going to take M. I've got to be very careful with my pronunciation, because M and N, could have chosen A and B, but M and N, we're a bit stuck with them. My brain wouldn't work if it was A and B. So M is an NN bimodule, right? It's an algebra containing another one. So you multiply the left and right by elements of N. And so therefore you can take the tensor product of M with itself over N. Okay, for if you've never seen this, if you've never seen these algebras, of course, are non-commutative, to be interesting. If you've never seen this, you just take the ordinary tensor product in the vector spaces and quotient out by the sort of middle linearity. So you have MN, M1N tensor M2 is the same thing in the quotient as M1 tensor NM2. Okay, just do the obvious thing. So that remains an NN bimodule. In fact, it's also an MM bimodule and all kinds of other things, but it's an NN bimodule, so you can also, once again, tensor it by M. Okay, and you can keep on doing this. And let's say you do it K times. Or K copies of M. So that would be K equals 4 in that particular case. All right, so what? Well, the deal here is that M is typically infinite dimensional. N is infinite dimensional. So you would expect M tensor over N times M, first tensor product, also to be infinite dimensional, and in fact to be somewhat bigger than M itself. Right, because if you do M, if you did a bigger space, M tensor M, then this is sort of tautologically equal to M. So this had better be bigger than M. And these are getting bigger and bigger and bigger. So you've got these horrible infinite dimensional algebras. And I've given you some even more infinite dimensional objects, so we seem a bit lost here. However, here's the deal. What we're going to take is we're going to take N central vectors, or N invariant vectors, N central invariant. So we're going to take a psi in this thing, and it's going to have the property that n psi equals psi n for all n in N. That's what I mean by an n central vector. Okay. All right. Now, I said that I was not going to tell you what these algebras are, but that they have certain nice properties. Nice property number one is that this space of central vectors is actually finite dimensional. Finite dimensional. So that's very interesting. We've started with this infinite dimensional inclusion here. We've got out some finite dimensional stuff. Don't know much about the stuff at the moment, but it's finite dimensional. And in fact, we have got a finite dimensional space for each K. So we will we'll finish the definition by saying PK PK is the set of all n central vectors in this K-fold tensor product, finite dimensional vector space. Okay, so what? Well, now I'm going to pull out the other nice property, which is guaranteed by the analysis. Okay, by the fact that these things are complete in a certain topology. Well, here, this is sort of stunning. If I, at least, you know, if I was listening and I'd understood everything I'd said up to now, I would be quite stunned by this next assertion. The assertion is that these vector spaces, PK, have a lot of the formal properties of Conway's tangles. Okay? That is to say that there is a way to put them in such a picture in exactly the same way that you put the tangles into a picture and you get another one. So so what I'm saying is I think of this disk as having an integer associated to it, which is half the number of boundary points. And if I did this right, it's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Oh, what? I think it's odd, isn't it?
Yeah.
Oh, Horace. So now it's even. So this is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, It's 10. So this disk has the number 5 associated with it. So the theorem that you can prove is that if you put a vector v in P5, so let me just write down P5 in there, into this one. This one is obviously associated with 2, so here you'll have an element in P2, and here an element in P2. Then that will construct for you an element in the vectors, this tangle here. There was a certain number of things on the boundary, so the boundary has 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. No, it can't be odd. That's the theorem. 2, 4, 6, 8, 10. So this will also be in P5. And that was, I don't want to have accidental occurrences of P5, so let's make it P6. Okay? So this is the amazing result, is that these central vectors have the same sort of structure in terms of these kind of tangles here as Conway's tangles had in knot theory. That is to say, you can insert them, you can take a diagram like this, and you can insert an element of P5 in here, an element of P2 in here, an element of P2 in here. You get out an element of P6, and that operation will have the same functorial properties as the tangles coming from knot theory had. Okay, the functorial properties involve sort of gluing. You can do glue here first and then here and so on. And all of those things are just as true for these central vectors as they were for tangles. Okay, so this is great. You're immediately led to say, well, maybe you could get knot invariants from von Neumann algebras. Okay, well, that's exactly reversing the direction of history if you said that, because in fact, what actually happened was the first one of these beyond the Alexander polynomial actually was discovered as a result of this kind of study here. But the way I'm presenting it now, I'm sort of going backwards in time. All right, anyway. Now, along with this, these theorems in analysis, basically the main names here are Popper and Octianu, two Romanians, who proved results along the lines that if you know, which we can interpret now, is if you know these vector spaces and you know how these tangles act on them, in other words, you know if you know exactly what happens when you put these vectors in these various tangles, what will come out. If you know that structure, then you actually know the subfactor. Okay? This theorem's along those lines. It's sort of amazing. And in fact, I can tell you how to actually construct the subfactor. I can do it for you right now. So let me do that. We want to get an infinite dimensional algebra and a subalgebra. Okay? So, and I'm allowed to do these tangles. Well, see, if I'm allowed to do the tangles, then there's a particular tangle. I'm going to now, this is the whole key, is to redraw these with disks, with rectangles instead of disks. Now, here's a tangle. Here's a tangle. And what will this tangle give us on our centralizers? Well, this rectangle, which is really a disk, of course, this has 8 boundary points, so this is an element of P4. So this says if you put in an element of P4 and another element of P4, you get out a third element of P4. Okay, so you have an operation on P4. 4 is obviously just n. So you have an operation on every Pn, and the formal properties of tangle calculus just immediately imply this associative. So just from this particular picture, each Pn is an associative algebra. Each Pn is an associative algebra. Now we just look at another very simple kind of tangle. This time with only one internal, one sort of input. And what is this? This is an element of Pn, and out of it comes an element of Pn plus 1. So this is a sort of inclusion of Pn in Pn plus 1. So, and this inclusion obviously respects the algebra structure. So in fact, we have got an increasing sequence of finite dimensional algebras. So in other words, whenever we have the structure that's coming from these central vectors, such as coming from knot theory, we actually have an increasing sequence of finite dimensional algebras. Now, we want to end up in this category of full Neumann algebra, so we take the P infinity and then we complete it a little bit to make it a full Neumann algebra. So we find some Hilbert space that it can act on, and we take a closure. So that ends up being M. Right, and now we have we have to equalize our right-hand, left-hand prejudice here. Why did I add the string to the right? Well, probably because I'm right-hand. But you see, we should also consider this tangle. This gives us a subalgebra, you see. This gives us another way to embed Pn in Pn plus 1. And so we can call this sort of Qn. And so we'll have Qn contained in P. Well, let's see. The way of doing Qn contained in Pn plus 1, Qn minus 1, and so on. And we'll have a Q infinity. Complete that, and we will have subalgebra in the limit. And these wonderful theorems of Popper and Octiano say, under the appropriate conditions, if you start off with an arbitrary subfactor, so you know nothing about it, you produce the sequence of invariants, you use the structure that they have, this tangle structure, and you can actually reconstruct a pair of algebras, and this pair of algebras is isomorphic to the one you started with. So you've actually, it's an amazing theorem, you've completely unraveled the structure of this, both these algebras and the inclusion of one in another. Okay, so that's great. Now, what this also means is that one way, if you're interested, as I certainly am, in this object here, these infinite dimensional full Neumann algebras, then one way to try to construct them is skein theory. You could try to look for systems which are, you know, which contain all of these operations. In other words, increasing sequences of vector spaces on which you can apply these tangles as operations. So you look around for them. Well, one obvious place to look is knot theory, right? They're supplied for you by all these polynomials. And that works. You get lots and lots of examples in that way. And this is the great feedback from knot theory to full Neumann algebras. You can indeed get lots and lots of these. You know, you have to be a bit careful with the parameters because you want to have an honest Hilbert space at the end with a positive definite inner product. But if you choose carefully, then all of these knot invariants that I've been talking about, these skein theoretic ones, will produce for you these full Neumann algebras. Ironically, except the Alexander polynomial that does not have the required positivity. But all of the new stuff sort of does. So, why are these two pictures different? Well, these tangles, you know, there's all kinds of little details I've been leaving out. And one of them is that these tangles, you always, in order to make things work properly, you have to have a sort of first point, a first boundary point. And that's the first boundary point here, that's the first boundary point here. So they're different because they're not there's no reason why they shouldn't be. All All right, so name of the game at the moment, for me anyway, is to try to construct these infinite dimensional algebras by going, not using the not theoretical ones, because they're the sort of, you know, they're all understood, right, in quotes. You know, we know how to do everything with those, but to try to look for new kinds of Skein relations. So what are going to be the ingredients? Well, you know, what were the ingredients in Conway's thing? We had this thing here. That was the fundamental object. So we're going to sort of replace that by something that doesn't necessarily have anything to do with knot theory. So we're just going to put something in there, basically a black box in there. We're going to put something we're just going to call R in there. And we're going to have a whole lot of those. These are going to be the generators of the theory. There'll be an R1, and then there'll be an R2, which might have somewhat more things coming out of it. An R1 and R2 and so on. These will be the generators. And then we'll have some relations. And the relations will simply be, you know, the generalization of what Conway was doing. So we'll have certain linear combinations with certain coefficients of tangles. And the tangle will be some way of putting these R's into a picture, like so. And this will have to be equal to zero. And given this picture, we will form the free vector space of all linear combinations of all tangles, where now by tangle I mean a picture like this, any picture like this with the R's inside it, modulo the relations.
Allowing crossings of the...
No. That's what I said. I wanted to clump all the crossings inside the,
okay,
the internal disks.
Things can't cross.
These things cannot cross, right. That's what I call planar algebra, because once, you know, we've gotten rid of all our crossings have been thrown into the things. The only thing that's guaranteed by this theorem up here is the thing with no crossings. So... right. So we can do this. All right, well, you can do it. I can do it. Anyone can do it. You can take some generators and write down some relations, and you should get garbage, right? That's what happens when you write down just any old generators and relations. However, we know there are things that don't give garbage. There's the Alexander polynomial, the Homfleet polynomial, the Kaufman polynomial, so on and so forth. So the question is, what do we mean by not garbage? Well, fortunately, we have this proper reconstruction theorem, which says that if you can get this thing to give you these algebras, then you've got a subfactor, and a subfactor, by definition, by you know, intimidation, is not garbage. Okay. So all we need is for these relations to satisfy the ingredients that give you this structure. And the main thing about this structure was the finite dimensionality. Okay, we want these spaces to be finite dimensional algebras. So there's the question. The question is now staring at everyone. What are the sets of relations around, generators and relations around, what are the sets of generators and relations around, such that if you take this manifestly infinite dimensional space of formal linear combination of the tangles, mod out by these relations, you get something finite dimensional. And not zero, of course. That would be another garbage. So the dimension of this has to be less than infinity. Okay. Now, remember, there's one of these for every k. So this would be k tangles. Because, you see, by this, you know, what we have gained from this process is, obviously, this structure will fit into these pictures. You can just combine these tangles. It was all formal, so you can just do it. So provided these quotients are finite dimensional, then basically you're in business and you've got a subfactor, and so you're very happy. Well, it all sounds extremely good, but in practice, so far, it hasn't worked out very well. I'm sorry to report, but I'm working on it. And what I can tell you is that there are some examples, okay, of new Skein theories that really have nothing to do with not theory, but which do have a role to play in subfactor theory and can be constructed in this way. And the first of them is one that I discovered together with Dietmar Bisch. I'll just say a few words about that and stop. So, should I finish pretty soon? Is that the message?
Like 5-10 minutes.
Okay, I should be able to do it in 5.
All right, so I guess there's a class at 4.
There's a class at 4, right. I'll just have a couple more minutes. Okay, now, so this example is going to be one where there's just a single generator. And it's something with only these spikes coming out of it, only 4 spikes coming out of it. So that means that these basic tangles are going to look essentially, for all the world, like the not-theoretic tangles, because you can just shrink these things to a point, and a tangle would just be something like that. Well, that would be a tangle with no boundary, and maybe it's got some boundary as well. So we're really dealing with things that look awfully like not-theory, but the point is the relations that this R satisfies are not the ones of knot theory. The ones of knot theory in particular are things like the Reitemeister moves, that this is equal to this, and so on. Well, so ironically, in spite of everything I'm saying, these do satisfy this, but they still have nothing to do with knot theory. This particular generator that Dietmar and I looked at, the relation is basically this. So I'll just draw it. It's this equals this equals this. Okay, so this is a skein relation. This is 2 skein relations. And it turns out by a very simple argument on reducing the size of faces in such a picture, you just go to one of these faces, you isolate this thing, and just apply this relation. You can always get faces smaller and smaller. This relation forces the finite dimensionality, and it has all the required positivity, and it gives you a subfactor which is sort of structurally related to, in fact, the existence of intermediate subalgebras in that thing. And the resulting algebra, I'll just give you the nice formula for the dimension. In this particular case, we call them these things the Fuchs-Catalan algebras, because this number is 1 over 2n plus 1 times 3n choose n. And you may have seen the so-called Catalan numbers, n plus 1, 2n choose n. So these are part of a series of numbers which generalize the Catalan numbers, which were discovered, whose remarkable properties were discovered by Herr Fuchs, 100 years before Catalan discovered the special series and its nice properties. But from this point of view, this is an example of skein theory in action producing an interesting subfactor. And I'll stop right there.
So does this new subfactor have an operator algebra interpretation?
Yeah, it absolutely does. That's right. What it is in terms of operator algebras is it corresponds to the following. If you happen to have, so in the sort of spirit of Galois theory, if you happen to have an intermediate subalgebra sitting between that one and that one, then you can take sort of orthogonal projection from this one onto this one. And that orthogonal projection is this element in the correspondence between the pictures. So these tangles have a very direct operator algebraic interpretation.
Any other questions? Okay, I guess we have to be out of here in 6 minutes, so I would suggest people join us for a beer afterwards. I don't know if you're game for that.
I'm game for that, yeah, sure.
Across the road. So if you have more questions, we can raise them then. Let's thank Vaughn one more time.